Remember when this happened in 2016?
I've never done this before. Can I have a pledge, a swearing? Raise your right hand. I do solemnly swear that I, no matter how I feel, no matter what the conditions, if there's hurricanes or whatever, will vote on or before the 12th for Donald J. Trump for president. Thank you. Now I know.
You may remember some of the headlines the following day comparing the arm-raising Trump rally to scenes from Nazi Germany. And there have, of course, been other Trump-Hitler comparisons since, when he called for a Muslim ban, when he said some white nationalists are good people, when he separated migrant children from their parents at the border. Now, some people say comparing Trump to Hitler is overheated or it's lazy. And those critics might invoke Godwin's law, which says, as an online discussion continues, the probability of a comparison to Hitler or to Nazis approaches one. Is it time to reconsider Godwin's law? Well, let's ask Godwin. Mike Godwin is the lawyer and the writer who came up with this axiom in 1990. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Will you remind us what point you were making when you made your Hitler comparison observation?
Sure. Well, let me tell you what point I wasn't making. Uh-huh. First, I wasn't telling people not to ever compare anyone to Hitler or to Nazis, but I was asking people or trying to urge them to do it thoughtfully and with an eye to real history, so that you don't do it just because you're mad at somebody, but you do it because you make that comparison to Hitler or to Nazis because you think it's really meaningful and it's substantially true. But of course, you know, the internet, when you say things on the internet, people, you know, sometimes they love what you say and then they use it for their own purposes. And some people, more in fun than in anything else, have said that when you get to the Hitler comparison, the discussion is over or you've done something wrong. I don't think that's always true.
Okay. Yes. You're not saying that you violated some law by bringing up Hitler at all. You're saying be thoughtful about it. And I wonder, decades on from when you came up with the phrase, with Godwin's law, how do you think about how Hitler comparisons are used today? Where would you use such a comparison?
Well, so I have a lot of thoughts about this, but I'll try, you know, in the interest of time, to keep them to one or two. And one of them is that the idea of remembering history and keeping in mind, you know, who Hitler was and what the Nazis were, and not making the comparisons frivolously, is what enables us nowadays to make meaningful comparisons if we see things like the rise of Duterte in the Philippines or of Hun Sen in Cambodia, and we say, well, that's a terrible movement in the direction of authoritarianism and dictatorship, and so we should do those comparisons. The thing that makes it meaningful is that we don't throw those comparisons around unless we are really historically grounded when we do it. That's the idea.
And Mike, you've said that Godwin's law is about remembering history well enough to draw a parallel. So let's bring in someone who does that professionally, Professor Lori Marhofer, University of Washington, a historian of Weimar and Nazi Germany. Good to have you back, Professor.
Hey, thanks, Bill.
Thanks for coming. Do you know one another, by the way, Professor and Mike Godwin?
No.
We haven't met. No.
Well, I'm glad to bring you together in this exact, you know, a productive discussion. Let me start generally with you, Professor Marhofer. What's your reaction to Nazi-Hitler comparisons and Godwin's law?
Well, I think it's interesting thinking about Godwin's law in the 90s and how self-evident that was and how we are in a different moment now where we're struggling for ways to talk about the far right. My experience of the 1990s was under the impression that it wasn't so relevant in this country. And now looking back, I think that was mistaken. But certainly now a lot more people see the extreme racist authoritarian right as far more important in our politics. And I think that people are trying to find ways to talk about it, you know, to talk about Charlottesville. There were people at Charlottesville who were frankly Nazis. Self-identified.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. So there's
sometimes
no
we talk about people misusing the term Nazi, and there's some confusion about that.
Yeah, neo-Nazis are Nazis. I think it would be doing them a disservice to say otherwise. There are
why is that? I mean, the Nazis, that was literally a party at one time. When we say neo-Nazi, I assume we're saying that these are people who weren't born then or responding to very different conditions, it may be useful to compare them to Nazis, but that a neo-Nazi is not literally a Nazi, and we should be careful. No, you're the historian.
Nazism is a form of fascism. It's the German variant of fascism, and it's a particular political philosophy. Mm-hmm. You can get books out of the library and read the major principles of fascism, like liberalism or communism. There is an intellectual tradition that existed after 1945, and there are Americans today who find it, you know, very useful and who self-identify with it.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy ran for president on the Nazi Party ticket in the 20th century in the Pacific Northwest. That guy was a Nazi, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. Yes, so, self-identified.
Yeah.
And we're talking with Mike Godwin, the writer and lawyer who sort of coined the idea, Godwin's Law, it came to be called. And I should remind you, in case you're just tuning in, that as an online discussion continues, the probability of a comparison to Hitler or to Nazis approaches one. And you were being sort of jocular there, I think, Mike, saying about how we can rush to an overheated or a lazy comparison. But has your thinking changed on that today?
Well, so I think that the natural human tendency when people have access to the internet and a lot of different voices and they're talking to each other on Facebook or on Twitter, especially if they don't have a generation or two of experience doing that, people get angry at each other. People learn that other people have really different opinions. And there's a tendency, I think, for when you're really exposed to a diversity of opinion and points of view to get frustrated and angry about it and to want to escalate the rhetoric. So I think that tendency is there. And much as I love the internet, I think it has enabled that tendency to be more accelerated. So I think that Godwin's Law identified that phenomenon, and I think it's still around today, especially as more and more people are join the first generation of people to get on the internet. You know, we really only have about half the population of the world at most online. So we've got another 3.5 billion people who are going to come online, and they're going to have the same learning curve that we all have had. And they'll get in arguments, and they'll meet, you know, they'll compare people to Hitler or, Pol Pot or Stalin. All those comparisons are going to happen.
Well, Professor Marhofer, there's a debate now about whether the Republican Congress should move to restrict Trump more, hold hearings, pass laws restricting what he can do, block his nominees. Is it fair to warn Republicans about how Germany's leadership accommodated Hitler in his early years? Is that a fair warning, you think? You know, politics aside, just from a historian's point of view.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of what historians do that's useful is offer points of comparison to what's going on today. So I wouldn't want to close down thoughtful, careful consideration of continuities like what Mike is talking about. I think that more useful comparisons than Germany in 1933 are, you know, Putin in 2000 or Duterte or some of these more recent examples of countries where a democratic government was slowly eaten away from within by the erosion of both formal legal norms, so voter suppression, for example, or vote rigging, and the erosion of informal norms. If you think about what happened with the Obama's last Supreme Court appointee and how that appointment was denied, nothing was illegal there, but that was a real breach of protocol up to that point that had a real effect. You know, the drawing of congressional districts in a way that favors one party over another. All of these things that I've talked about are things you can see in other countries in the second half of the 20th century, where a democratic regime slowly became an authoritarian one. And I'm convinced by political science. There's a great book about this called How Democracies Die that came out recently, but I'm really convinced by that those are the more important points of comparison. And indeed, warning for Republicans in Congress, than 33 in Germany.
By the way, sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you. Mm-hmm. But I like that book too. And I think one of the things that it really underscores is that democracies are inherently fragile. That is to say, because democracies make, you know, try to give everyone a voice, some of the voices will be anti-democratic voices. And so there's always the potential for a democracy, no matter how well designed it is, to be undercut by anti-democratic voices that take advantage of democratic institutions. And the United States, I think, we've had this dream of ourselves as being institutionally immune to that problem. But I don't see that we are. You know, Sinclair Lewis, the novelist, wrote a book in the 1930s called It Can't Happen Here. And it was about the creation of a fascist state after the Roosevelt administration in the 1930s. And it reads as quite credible to me, and it's not about Nazis at all. It's about how fragile democratic institutions can be when there are populist impulses that want to undercut them.
Well, sometimes in a discussion, it's handy to have a powerful symbol that you can pull out and get people's attention. Mike, if we want to, let's say we're having an online discussion, or I suppose an in-person one, if you want to alarm, if you want to raise concerns about the gradual erosion of norms, the rule of law, as we said, voting rights, you know, enemies lists, what is a better argumentative tool or image than Hitler?
Well, so I've given this a lot of thought, and I think I should confess that one of the reasons I came up with Godwin's Law is I felt that temptation in myself from time to time before I invented Godwin's Law to make those comparisons when I saw, you know, authoritarian impulses in the online world. I think the trick to this is not how to figure out the right hammer to hammer your opponent with or the right comparison. I think the if you're arguing with someone who is amenable to finding common ground, then I think one of the things we have to learn is to very self-consciously engage in a lot of what are called alternative dispute resolution strategies, which is to find, you know, to restate other people's point of view in ways that make it clear that you understand them, that, so that they're heard. And one of the things that I've found, and I think other people have found online, is that if the people you're arguing with feel that they've been heard, they sometimes are more willing to hear a different point of view. And that, I think, is ultimately going to be the way we restore the common ground that underlies American democracy.
Well, that's very interesting. Professor, can you look at history and point to examples of where not being alarmist, but instead hearing other parties, letting them know they've been heard, you know, restating their point of view, have you found that to be useful in keeping societies on the rails?
Yeah, I think if democracies are fragile and they work best when there's a general commitment to democratic principles that people adhere to above their commitments to winning whatever their political goals are. So living in a democracy means compromising, and it does mean allowing other people to have their say and listening.
But do you have a message for someone who's saying, do you know someone who, or do you see people in Seattle crossing the line, whether it's, you know, I don't know, this is not my president, or, you know, is anything overheated in the debate, the anti-Trump resistance?
Well, I think there are two things going on. I think that fascism, the German fascism, Nazism in the United States has come to stand in for the ultimate evil, and that when people are in online chat rooms, or when my father-in-law is frustrated because he got a ticket for wearing his seatbelt improperly, there's an impulse to pull out your nuclear weapon and talk about fascism. I think Godwin's made some good points about that. And then I think people are also watching the rise of the populist authoritarian right around the world right now. The right that we're seeing in the United States, there are certainly factions of it that are neo-Nazi, but a lot of it is not that similar to fascism at all. But I think people don't have ways to talk about it, and their frame of reference is Nazism, so they go back to that. Nazism was also a populist right authoritarian movement, although it was very different from what we're seeing. I do think it's interesting to chew this over, but I also think people should be careful. I would not compare the clip that you played of Trump asking people to promise to vote for him. I would not compare that to anything that Hitler did. I thought that was that's the kind of comparison to Nazism that I.
There was the raising the right hand bit. He did ask them to raise their right hands.
He did. He did. But there's lots of other. Hitler was also a vegetarian. And he loved dogs. I don't think
that's right.
I mean, I really agree with you that you have to be very careful and you have to be able to back up your point. And I think there are, you know, thinking about the upcoming elections, there are people who kind of lean Trump but are moderate who I think get enraged when leftists compare Trump to Hitler. And I think strategically leftists ought to be a little bit careful about it.
We're not telling you, declaring that it's right or wrong to evoke historical comparisons, but we are urging you to be thoughtful and historical and proportional, and we'll try to keep our democratic norms together here. We've been talking about this so-called Godwin's Law with Mike Godwin, the lawyer and writer who came up with his observation about Hitler comparisons back in 1990. Mike, thank you for this.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thanks so much.
And Professor Lori Marhofer, assistant history professor, University of Washington, and she studies just that, Weimar Germany and Nazi Germany. Good to see you again, and I bet we'll talk again. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Good to be here. Thanks, Bill.